Well, we're living in tough and testing times. I don't need to tell you that. Politically testing, emotionally testing. For some of us, financially testing, relationally testing, and spiritually testing as well. We're seeing things, hearing things that raise a lot of questions in our minds. We wonder, does God know? Does our King still reign? Is our King in control? Does our King care for us? Questions that trouble us and vex us. And the message of Daniel 1 that we will look at tonight can be summed up like this. Our King uses the hardest tests to produce the best results. And in doing so, he shows us his care for us. Our King cares for us because he uses the hardest tests to produce the best results. That's what we'll see tonight in Daniel 1. Some of you might be asking, what happened to Wisdom University? Well, we'd been in Wisdom University for about a year, one long year semester. And I figured it was time for a break, a little sabbatical. So I thought I would take us to Babylon University. From one extreme to the other, we can learn from both. And just do a short series on this book of Daniel. And really, you know, Babylon University is the hardest university in the world. It's got campuses everywhere. And we're all students in it. And we need to learn how to live in it, how to learn from it too, indeed how to flourish in it. A bit of background to this book. We kind of know the story, but where does this story fit in the history of the Bible? Well, let's say roughly about 600 years before Christ, God disciplined his people by sending them into exile because of their sins, especially their sins of idolatry. He allowed Babylon to come, led by King Nebuchadnezzar, capture his people, and carry them off to Babylon in three stages until they were all there. And, you know, when you read this, it's in verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. It looks like the Babylonian king is in control. But what we're told here at the very beginning of the chapter is the King of Kings is behind it all. Because look at the next verse. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. So, yes, it looked like the king of Babylon had come and taken Jehoiakim, but here we're being told it was actually God who gave Jehoiakim into the hands of the king of Babylon, and he wouldn't have been taken unless he was given. Yes, the king of Babylon's powerful, but the King of Kings is far more powerful. The whole book, in fact, is really telling us there is a King of Kings. There is a king in Babylon who's greater than the king of Babylon. And in a day when we see so much accumulation of power politically, even technologically and economically, and it all looks so daunting and fearful, we need to remember there is a King of Kings. There's a king in Silicon Valley who's the king of Silicon Valley. And there's a king in Washington who's the king of all who are in Washington. And so we want to remind ourselves of this continually. And really the book, it divides into two. The first six chapters are stories, really, and these stories tell us about faithful living in hostile times. It's really showing us Daniel and his friends living faithfully in the midst of much hostility. And then chapters 7 to 12, they're much more prophetic, a lot of symbolism and imagery. And you could sum up these last six chapters, chapters 7 to 12, like this: forward-looking in hostile times. And we need to do both. We need faithful living in hostile times, but we still need to be forward-looking in hostile times. So we start this evening with chapter 1, and it's telling us, trust the king's care. Our king cares for us. Trust that, because he uses even the hardest, the toughest tests for the very best results. So we want to ask first, what are these tests? And we want to see them in the life of Daniel. And this passage tells us in verses 1 through 7, we will be tested in Babylon University. We will be tested. We will be examined. We will be put through the ringer. And we see that in the life of Daniel in six ways, six tests that we have here in these verses. There's, first of all, the test of spiritual defeat. And that's in verses 1 and 2. Because this was not just a political defeat, this was a spiritual defeat. Notice, it's not just the king of Babylon took the king of Jerusalem. If you look at verse 2, it says, the king Nebuchadnezzar took some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. What happened here? What happened is Nebuchadnezzar comes with Babylon, eventually actually destroys the whole temple of God, raises it to the ground, but here he takes some of the furniture, some of the treasury out of God's house in Jerusalem, takes them and puts them in his idol's house in Babylon. And what's he telling us by this? He's saying, my God is far more powerful than Israel's God. Look, we've captured his stuff, and it's now serving our God. This looked like a dreadful spiritual defeat, much more than something just national. And politically, it looked as if God had lost. And then, secondly, here we've got the test of seductive pleasures. Seductive pleasures. We see that in verse 3. The king commands the head of the civil service, Ashpenaz, to bring some of the people of Israel, the royal family, the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, skillful in all wisdom. So he really picks the cream of the crop here. And he brings them to stand in his palace to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. Now, Daniel's about 14 years old at this point. Okay, he's pretty young. And here he is. He's been taken away from his home, from his family. He's been taken into a foreign country, completely foreign culture, foreign language. And the king's chief civil servant comes and says, hey, Daniel and your friends, come with me. I'm going to give you royal positions and royal privileges. That is pretty tempting, isn't it? He's really saying, Daniel, you can have from me, from the king, high living and the high life. I mean, he's the lowest of the low at the moment. He's like a little boy lost in this foreign country, and the king comes and says, hey, I'll make you one of my princes. That's pretty tempting. That's pretty seductive, isn't it? That's a real test. But then there's another test that comes here, the test of spiritual isolation. You see that in verses 3 and 4, he's really being taken away from even the small community of God's people in Babylon, and he's being isolated from them and put amongst the Babylonians alone. This is what Sinclair Ferguson says about this test. They were isolated from the influences that would mold their lives and characters in the ways of the Lord. In Babylon, they were separated from the regular public worship of God, from the teaching of the Word of God, from the fellowship and wisdom of the people of God, and from the daily illustration of what it meant to be a citizen of Jerusalem. Separated from the furnace of godliness, the king anticipated that the last dying embers of true faithfulness to the Lord would die out. It's a big test. Will these embers die out when isolated from what keeps them glowing and burning? And then there's a test, fourthly, of secular influence, because they're not just isolated from truth, they're indoctrinated in error. They're enrolled in a 3-year degree program, and its title is The Literature and Language of the Babylonians. You see that at the end of verse 4. Why did the king devise this plan? Well, he knew, if I can change the way that Daniel and his friends think, I can change what they believe and I can change how they live. The king knew that the way into Daniel's life and anyone's life really is through the mind. And therefore, he brings the literature and the language of the Babylonians. He's now bringing the whole cultural background of Babylon, and he's saying, I want these young men immersed in this. I want them indoctrinated. I want them brainwashed, as it were, in the secular literature, the secular way of thinking, in the secular world view. Then it goes further. Fifthly, there's a test of small compromise. Small compromise. The king assigns in verse 5 a daily portion of the food that he ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years at the end of that time. They were to stand before the king. And we learn later, Daniel refuses this food. And we want to ask why. Well, the food that was offered to the king, that the king then offered to Daniel, it came to the king via the idol temple in Babylon, and it was offered to the idol with worship that said, "You idol are the giver of every good gift." So this was food that was stamped with heresy, you might say, food that was stamped with a false theology, food that had been attributed to a piece of stone and metal and wood and gold. And Daniel knew this. He was aware of this, and so when it came to him, though it was the juiciest steak and the finest wine, he said no. Now, it wasn't a huge deal, you might have said. You know, that it's not like a massive sin, is it? It's relatively small in the range of moral offenses. I mean, he's not actually worshiping the idol himself. He's not actually in the temple. It's at best, or at worst, second or third degree removed from the sin. And yet, Daniel sees it's a compromise. Though small, he could not approve of. And then there's a sixth and final test, the test of identity theft. Look at their names. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Whatever you see names in the Bible with El or Yah in them, that's the name of God. These four men had God's name in their names. That was their identity. They were God's people, the God of Israel. And that is why this chief civil servant comes along and says, let's have some new names here. I mean, you're in Babylon now, so let's have some Babylonian names. And, surprise, surprise, or not, the four names he gives them all have the name of the Babylonian gods in them. And so instead of daily being reminded of their primary identity as the people of God, they would have that obliterated. It would be removed. It would be gradually erased. And instead, when that identity was stolen, it would be replaced with this false identity containing the names of false gods. We will all be tested in Babylon University. In one of these ways, or perhaps all of these ways. And these tests, you know, they're not violent. You think of Egypt. When it tested Israel, it was like a torture, wasn't it? It was force. It was aggressive. This wasn't so much persecution. but assimilation. Slow, gradual merging with Babylon. The taste of assimilation. Will they merge? So, two different tastes: Egypt, persecution; Babylon, assimilation. But the aim is the same: to obliterate God, God's name, God's people, God's testimony from the earth. It's really, ultimately, overall, these tests are the test of Babylonization. Will we be Babylonized? And, you know, I believe assimilation is more dangerous than persecution. I think assimilation is more of a threat to God's people than persecution. Because it's much more subtle. It doesn't look so devilish. It's much more skillful, you would say. Much harder to resist, and it often comes much slower. So that it's like, you know, the lobster in the boiling pot. It just happens so gradually. You hardly notice it, you hardly feel it until it's too late. This is a test of assimilation, and we're all going through it in different ways. Spiritual defeat, seductive pleasures, spiritual isolation, secular influence, small compromise, and identity theft. Daniel 1 comes to us and says, when you're tested with Babylonization, where will your loyalties lie? Who will you remain loyal to? This chapter brings before us two great cities, Jerusalem and Babylon. And in the Bible, these two cities represent two great forces, two great powers, not nationally, not politically, but spiritually. Jerusalem is representative of the people of God. Babylon is all that is against God. And it really goes right back to Genesis 3:15, where you've got the seed of the woman, God's people, and the seed of the serpent, Babylon. You see it in the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11. You see it all through, and you see it here again. The seed of the woman is still being threatened by the seed of the serpent. Babylon is still trying to get rid of the name of God. In fact, this goes all through the Bible. You go to the very last chapters of the Bible. In Revelation 18 to 19, you want to read that maybe? It's all about this. Babylon the Great has fallen. It's looking ahead. And it's saying, no matter how great Babylon appears just now, the day is coming when God's people will say, Babylon the Great has fallen. It's defeated. It's utterly destroyed. The seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent. And you go to the next two chapters, the last chapters of the Bible, and what's the message? New Jerusalem has come down from heaven as a bride from God. It doesn't matter how powerful Babylon becomes, the New Jerusalem will be the city that stands and that lasts. And so Daniel's message is, where do my loyalties lie? Babylon or Jerusalem? The seed of the woman, Christ, or the seed of the serpent, Babylon and the devil? So you might say, well, I'm really nervous about these tests. I'm going to be tested in Babylon University. I'm really nervous about this. Can I stand? Can I stay? Can I last? That's the next message. We can stay pure in Babylon. Yes, we'll be tested greatly, severely, repeatedly, but we can stay pure in Babylon. That's what Daniel encourages us with. Notice in verse 8, but Daniel, all these tests pile up. Babylonization is just about to sweep him away. And we read these glorious words, but Daniel resolved. And it's literally, he determined in his heart. He saw all this externally, and he knew the source of defense and power was internal, and he had to get his heart right with God. And he resolves, I will not defile myself with the king's food. He draws a line in the sand, a spiritual line in the sand. He looks at this food and he says, it looks delicious, but it's defiling. He knows eating this and drinking this would please the king of Babylon, but displease the King of Kings. And so he resolves, he decides, he determines, I will not defile myself. I'm going to stay pure. I'm making a spiritual resolution. I'm not going to taste it. I'm not going to touch it. He's asserting his God-given identity and distinctiveness. He's resisting assimilation. He's resisting Babylonization, even in the midst of Babylon and all its powerful influences upon him. And it's interesting, you know, when he goes to the chief civil servant, he's not obnoxious. He's not offensive. If you look at the words, it talks about really him reasoning with the chief civil servant. So he resolves to be faithful, but then he explains his faith. So he goes and he asks the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. Now that's pretty strong. He could use an excuse. He could have pled allergies or something, but no, he says, no, I'm not going to defile myself. He uses pretty strong language, but he explains it. He asks. And then we read, God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. He was able to do this in such a way that it softened the heart of the civil servant and persuaded him to give him a hearing. And so they start a little dialogue, and the chief civil servant saying, well, I'm a bit afraid that, you know, you guys are going to suffer and the king of Babylon's going to be mad with me and I'll lose my head. And so Daniel says, well, let's do a little experiment. Let's test this for 10 days. He's getting very reasonable, very wise, very tactful. He's very firm. He's very resolute. He's not a wimp, but he's very wise and winning in the way he presents his argument. He resolves to be faithful, and he explains his faith reasonably. And God honored Daniel's faithfulness by giving him this favor with this chief civil servant and persuading him to go along with this test. So as we look at these two steps in this story, Daniel's resolve and Daniel's explanation, his firm resolve and his tactful explanation, we ask, what can we learn from it? Well, this. Be faithful in small things. You know, it's very tempting at times to say, well, that's not a big test. And, you know, is it worth spending my capital and, you know, jeopardizing relationships and maybe my position, my influence? Maybe we should just wait until there's a bigger test, a more public test. And Daniel's, no, this is very private. It's just between themselves. And it's pretty small. It's not massive. He resolves to be faithful in small things, small challenges, private, unseen, relatively unseen matters. But this faithfulness in small things prepared him and his friends for faithfulness in big things. They didn't get barbecued in the furnace because they refused the king's barbecue. Daniel did not get swallowed by the king of the jungle because he refused to swallow the king's food. You see, the small tests, the small challenges he's faithful in, and it trains him and it prepares him for the big things down the road. And then this, an exiled heart is a resolved heart. You know, exiles I'm one. We kind of get more patriotic when we're away from our own nation. Isn't that a weird thing? Like, you think of St. Patrick's Day in America. It's far more celebrated than back in the Republic of Ireland. So it's their opportunity, the Irish opportunity, to assert their identity, their distinctiveness, and what they value. And they really grasp it with both hands, and they go at it with all they have. They cultivate this exile heart because it helps them resolve to continue their tradition, their heritage. So that sense of being an exile encourages them to maintain their real first identity. And I believe that's what Daniel and his friends are doing here. An exiled heart is a resolved heart. You can be a refugee. You can be traveling the world. But if you remember where your citizenship is, that your citizenship is in heaven, then you'll be able to make these resolutions to be faithful to God. You think of Psalm 137. It tells us of the exiles in Babylon gathering by the rivers of Babylon, and it says, by the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. They gathered, they sang, they remembered Jerusalem, they sang songs about Jerusalem, and it said, if I ever forget Jerusalem, let my tongue be cut off. See what they're doing? They're cultivating this identity of an exile in a foreign land in order to maintain spiritual resolve and determination. And therefore, Daniel's saying to us, cultivate an exile heart, an exile identity, a pilgrim identity, in order to maintain spiritual resolution. Well, you might ask, does faithfulness not mean loss? Well, there is some loss at times, but there's more gain. So yes, we'll be tested in Babylon University, but we can remain pure in Babylon University, and we can flourish in Babylon University. Not just survive, not just status quo, not just maintain what we have, not just a holding operation, but actually flourish and bloom and thrive and grow and progress spiritually. Sometimes Babylon University helps us flourish even more than Wisdom University. You actually need both. You're kind of dual enrolled. You know, some plants don't thrive unless they are buffeted. And that's the same with the Christian. We need Wisdom University, but we also need Babylon University. We need opposition. We need trial. We need testing if we're going to grow and progress and thrive. And so that's what we see here. We see Daniel and his friends physically flourishing in verses 15 and 16. At the end of the 10 days, they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. There was intellectual flourishing. We see that in verses 17 to 19. They gave up steak, dessert, and wine, but they got wisdom and learning and understanding in spiritual things especially. They stood up to the king, and therefore, as we're told here, they stood before the king, verse 19. And then there was spiritual flourishing in verse 20. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters. Here's all his religious, spiritual advisors, and it's not just that they were equal or slightly better, they were actually 10 times better. 10 times more wisdom and understanding than all these spiritual religious leaders. So there's physical flourishing, intellectual flourishing, spiritual flourishing, and even their longevity, their age. You look at that last verse, it doesn't seem a big verse, but it is. It says, Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. you know where that places Daniel? Verse 21 takes us right to the end of Daniel's life. This was 70 years later. So Daniel served from age 14 to age 84 in Babylon University. 70 years. And Nebuchadnezzar's long gone. In fact, Babylon's long gone. It's been taken over. But Daniel's still there. He stood up, therefore he's still standing. We can flourish. We can flourish in Babylon University. Kings come and kings go, but the King of Kings is faithful to his faithful people. So we leave this chapter asking this question: are you faithful by faith? Daniel was faithful. That's what we always think about with Daniel, his faithfulness. How was he faithful, though? Well, Hebrews 11 tells us, it doesn't name Daniel, but it tells us of one of his exploits. By faith, he shut the mouths of lions. So we know this was not just Daniel's self-resolve, self-discipline, self-determination. No, Daniel was faithful through faith in Christ, the coming Messiah, and we'll see him revealed as we go through this book. Daniel was faithful because his whole hope was in Jesus Christ. In fact, when we look at this book, it's not so much about the faithfulness of Daniel. That's there. But it's much, much more about the faithfulness of God. That God is faithful. Indeed, it points us ultimately to Christ as our faithfulness. You know, sometimes we think of Christ's faithfulness, and he was tested in Babylon University, wasn't he? More than anyone else, both with persecution and assimilation. He kept himself pure in Babylon University, and he flourished in Babylon University. He was given a great legacy and heritage to share with us. And when we hear that, we're tempted to think, okay, well, I was kind of like 50% faithful or 60% faithful. This great Christ can top up my faithfulness. He can give me that remaining 40%. Isn't that great? That's not great. That's not the gospel. Christ is not a top up. He's from bottom to top. He's everything. Our total faith is in his total faithfulness. Christ's faithfulness isn't there as a fallback. It's there as a fall forward. It's not a last resort. It's a first resort. So remember this. Christ's faithfulness is not our fallback. It's our fall forward. It's what we cast everything onto. All our weight, all our hopes, 100% of our future heavenly hope, it's all totally, completely in Christ. Christ's faithfulness is not our fallback. Never think that. It wasn't Daniel's. It's what we fall forward into completely and totally. We let go of all that we're holding on to, all our faithfulness as well. We put it all aside and we say, I have total faith in your total faithfulness. And that's why we can say, trust the King's care. Because he uses the toughest tests to produce the best results. Let's pray.